VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to the Game World Cup podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, joined by Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Now, later on, we've got a very special preview section of the show looking at England against Wales. But for now, we've got to jump right in. It's finally happened. The hipster clash we've all been waiting for. Two middling sides in a group with it all to play for in a second game, going at it, finishing 3-3, which basically leaves them in no good state whatsoever. Cameroon 3, Serbia 3. Game of the tournament, Gregor Robertson.
Without a doubt, it was an absolute belter. Just so many kind of moments and diversions that you just did not see coming in the game. I thought that Serbia were completely out of sight. First of all, I couldn't see Cameroon, apart from an odd break up the pitch, doing much. And then they obviously took the lead. And then Serbia with two goals in kind of first half stoppage time. Another straight after the break. That was a great goal, the third goal. Mitrovic's team move. So many times people could have shot and there was composure and one more pass. Easy finish for Mitrovic. And you thought they were in complete control. And then on comes Vincent Aboubakar and absolutely changed the game. He was remarkable. It was pretty straightforward. I mean, what he did was he ran in behind their defence. he made forward runs, whereas Tchouaméni was a kind of target man and he didn't really commit anyone forward. They had to do something, as we've seen so many times in the last couple of days. It's getting to the point where teams, if they're behind, they have to go for it. And Cameroon went for it, and Aboubakar's goal was extraordinary. I think it was a kind of finish where he thought he was offside. I'll just try this. You know what I mean? And then somehow VAR said it was a goal, and he was celebrating. And then unselfishness to square for the equaliser, and still there could have been more goals after it. It was without doubt the best game of the tournament, and I think it'll take some topping.
It means I'm not going to take any notice of semi-automated offsides anymore. I mean, that's meaningless, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I was saying in the office earlier, this felt like one of the only times I can remember where a goal was flagged offside and then given afterwards. Which is why it lends it to Gregor's theory that he just thought, oh, sod it, I'm just going to try a little stupid chip into the goal. You're right, Alison, completely bizarre.
I mean, I don't blame the human element of the flag, because even looking at it afterwards, I thought it was offside and there'd been some sort of major glitch. It was only when much later you were shown the lines and it was just onside. But what's the point? What is the point of the chip in the ball and the semi-automated system if it's flawed and requires deep analysis? I mean, it was like that. I mean, I don't know. No, but I don't think anybody in the stadium thought it. He was onside. So that
even the initial replay, you saw it and you thought, oh, he's off.
Yeah, exactly. But I do agree with you. I think it helped him score, because sometimes you see, how often do you see that? The flag goes, I mean, I know the flag hadn't quite gone up, but he thought he was offside, and the demeanour of the stadium was one of offside. So when that happens, the player sort of does something either tricksy or silly or petulant. I mean, he might have gone for petulant, imagine that. But he went for, I'll just chip the keeper. What the heck? It's probably offside. Never mind. But when you relax like that, you can do wonderful things. So it was utterly bizarre. But what struck me about the game was really that we saw two completely different Serbia teams. In the first game, they were so deferential and scared of their own shadows slightly and didn't really look, just looked wimpy and not the sort of passionate Serbia I was expecting. I mean, it's really easy to give Brazil that sort of deference given their history and their current squad, but it did seem disappointing from a Serbia point of view. And they were the complete opposite. against Cameroon, they part of the reason the game panned out as it did, it went, as you say, Gregor, they were in control, but their defending was very naive and they were very high up the pitch. They were acting like a team that felt they were going to go on to win by a high margin and were going to have fun and be aggressive. And, well, it backfired horribly, didn't it? But I think of all the games I've seen, and I've seen them all, I think that's the example of a team, maybe England running them a close second in this, where the first game and the second game, the difference in personality and approach, it was phenomenal. And actually, the naive team here was the European team.
Yeah, I would be a wee bit. I would have a slightly different view about the first game. I thought they did well to hold out for an hour. I thought they were quite resolute. And yes, they didn't have the same level of ambition. But I actually judged Brazil's performance and result better because of the opposition. I think Serbia are a good side. But they just clearly have a self-destruct button. Because there was periods of the game where they were outstanding. The two wing-backs were brilliant. Zivkovic, particularly on the right. And Tadic and Milinkovic-Savic behind Mitrovic. You know, all linking up really well. And they were all involved, I think, in that third goal I mentioned. So, you know, I know it was a collapse. And there was some really kind of comical, almost comical defending in the second half. But I still wouldn't rule them out. There's going to be so many groups on this last day that are just going to be fascinating.
No, I still love Serbia. Don't get me wrong, but I just felt we saw. I mean, for example, I think my favourite celebration of the tournament so far is Pavlovic's goal, because that was their first goal, and he's a defender, and his face contorted, and the whole bench and the whole backup team and everybody just went absolutely crazy. It had that feel of it being the winner of a major tournament feel to it. It was such a breakthrough for them. And the reason I actually don't know if anyone remembers it, but I predicted that that we might have the Alexander Mitrovic might be the leading golden boot contender for this World Cup, which now seems slightly unlikely, but at least he got off the mark. But maybe it was that, you know, the space-time continuum was upset because there were two Mitrovic's on the pitch and that shouldn't happen at all.
And two Milinkovic-Savic as well.
It's weird, isn't it? And,
oh, yes, some very common names there.
A game that quite literally had everything. And even some of the themes that we've been noticing in this World Cup, as you say, a high line leading to entertaining games. We saw that with Saudi Arabia, of course, in their famous win over Argentina. And Alison, you touched on it there. Pavlovic's goal, one of two in the 6 minutes of added time in this first half. I kept looking up at the screen going, is this the first half they've scored that second goal in? I couldn't quite believe it. Now, a key question for both of you. We're picking it as the game of the tournament so far, in the way that we're cool kids, you know, on the game podcast. We pick Cameroon v Serbia. Are either Mitrovic's team goal, Gregor, you picked it out already, or Aboubakar's, I'm offside, I'm going to chip it anyway, either of them getting anywhere near Richarlison's as goal of the tournament?
Absolutely. Both for very different reasons. I mean, the scoop was remarkable. It's just, it's one of those, again, that kind of, your mind sort of twisted a bit by it because you think, oh, it's almost been ruined by the fact that, by VAR, but then you go, oh, hang on a minute, it wouldn't have counted without VAR. So they kind of, you know what I mean? It's like sometimes the offside flag or VAR can, sometimes players are reticent to celebrate as well. But this was just a bit of a mind bender. So that was a remarkable finish, absolutely. And that was the best team goal as well so far. Yes, I would say they're both better.
Yeah, I had a wonderful, slightly cringy moment in the office where I've been trying to pay attention, particularly when I know I'm on the podcast, to these games. So I sit there and sometimes have my headphones in, listening to the commentary. And my colleague revealed that after Mitrovic's goal, I shouted in Alan Partridge fashion, "Total football!" Which is not a phrase often heard on the Times floor, let me tell you. Alison, you must have seen many wonderful, eloquent chips in your time as a football reporter. How does this compare with some of the best?
I think it's unlike anything I've seen because of how we've discussed the sense that it didn't count, but it did count. I'm not sure. Maybe because VAR hasn't been around long enough for that to be a factor. I liked it a lot. Let's put it that way. I liked it a lot. And I was rooting for Serbia, so it must have been darn good, mustn't it?
Also, it still had a bit of jeopardy because it spent a long time in the air and then you thought, yeah, it might bounce over. But no, it bounced and went into the roof of the net. So, yeah, that was a cracker. Brilliant moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, huge, huge credit to Vincent Aboubakar then in that sense, because is this right? We finally found a goal which is justifying the existence of VAR for Alison Rudd.
Well, no, because it spoiled it, didn't it? Because an element of VAR is the new form of, you know, chip-assisted offside, and that failed. So even when VAR gets something right, it gets something wrong.
Oh, no. I thought we had a full house. I thought we had a game that had done it all. A game that also, by the way, let's be honest, let's not forget the important introduction of Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting, the Stoke and PSG legend, because as good as Aboubakar was, I thought he was an important factor off the bench. So this game really had everything. And Alison, if only you'd said it converted you onto a fan of VAR, then we really would have had a full house. But
did you really think that was going to happen, Tom?
No, I didn't. But I thought I'd set it up anyway, just to give you the chance. You'll keep the listeners guessing. Just when we thought we'd had all our fun for the day, along came the next game, South Korea 2, Ghana 3. Alison, what did you make of this one?
Yeah, well, I was expecting to have a bit of a breezy time. But I don't know, they're two teams that it's hard not to feel a fondness for various reasons. I won't go into all of them. But I like the character and the vibe of them both. And there were scenes of the Ghana team arriving, and they pointed out on the BBC, look, they haven't all got their earphones in. They're not they're in their own little bubbles, the players. They were singing, they were playing drums, they were clapping, they were acting like they were a group of supporters. And this was, as you know, as they got off the bus and walking into the stadium. So you think, okay, they're looking quite relaxed. How is this going to play out in the game? And I don't know if there's a link between their performance and their attitude beforehand, but I'd like to think there is, because it was the sort of football that you play when you're confident and you have faith in each other and you have a belief in your system. And so they take a 2-goal lead. They've worked out, and they, you know, it was quite clearly a plan to expose the lack of confidence in the South Korea keeper, if I can put it that way. It seems a bit mean to point out he's not the tallest, but he doesn't command his area. So they were exploiting that. They were just getting the ball floating in above his head. And so he just couldn't, his reach, he couldn't quite get there. And they were being very aggressive in those situations. And it paid off twice. South Korea played nice football along the ground. They were, their character was great. They kept going, they kept plugging away. They played neat little triangles. It was nice. But Ghana, you know, the players who had belief in the system managed to get the winner. It was all done in a very short space of time. And it was thrilling. It was thrilling stuff. It was great. It was one of those games where you don't want either side to lose, really. And you'd like them both to progress in the tournament because of their approach to the football, which is that they, as you know, I bang on a lot about, I don't know what the England psyche vibe is. I don't know what England style is, but I feel like you can identify clearly how South Korea play and how Ghana play, and it sort of was exhibited to us in this game. It was great fun and showed the value of analysing your opponent, working out the weak spots and exploiting them. It's not that difficult, is it?
The only thing I would say is that it took South Korea until the second half of their second game to show us what exactly their identity is and how we know they can play. They're technically really good. My two biggest takeaways from this game and from today is this, that I'm still a massive fan of the cross and header finish. Like, Kim Jin-soo, two crosses in the second half for Gwae-sung were just, like, exquisite. The first one was on a plate, and the second one, it's one of those where he's kind of race running out of pitch, and you're not sure whether he's going to get to it or not, and he cuts it back, and it's again on a plate. They were brilliant goals. Up there were the best goals to watch, I think, in football. And also, I'm a big fan of the extra stoppage time. I mean, it's creating more drama. We're just getting more drama and more football. And we saw some serious drama at the end with the manager, Paolo Bento, South Korea manager, racing over to the referee to berate him for not letting them take a corner when he'd already gone over the allotted 10 minutes. You know, it was kind of, how long do you want us to play for?
But it is a common misconception in football that the laws of the game state that you allow as long as it needs for a penalty to be taken, but you do not have to allow a corner to be taken.
But no, this is, again, this is another hugely enjoyable game. And I've omitted to mention Jordan Ayew's cross for Ghana's second as well. Beautiful in-swinging ball. And Mohamed Kudus is a star. He's a real standout for Ghana. And Ghana in the first half were so dominant. I love their shape. They look really well organised, committed players forward. They were brave. And then you have to say that South Korea were brave in the second half and made a real game of it. And you have to give, as well, Ghana credit for coming back after that. Another cracker, absolute cracker. And I agree with Alison, it was almost a game where you wanted to be a draw.
Yeah, it felt a bit like a cup game to me. I know the first one was the kind of had everything in that Serbia-Cameroon game, but this one felt like a bit of a ding-dong, back-and-forth cup match. And I think in terms of the tactics as well, Alison, you talked about South Korea not showing it, and Gregor, you kind of slightly critically said they didn't show it till the second half. But to talk about your points, Gregor, in terms of get the ball in the box, if you've got good delivery, get the balls in the box, it felt to me like South Korea just kind of went in at halftime and went, well, that seemed to work against us. Why don't we try it against them? Why don't we just get the ball wide and get it in the box? Because we can't defend it. Maybe they can't defend it either. And it was, as you say, Greg, it's quite old-fashioned, get it in the mixer, but it worked every time. And I'm very pleased that you picked out Jordan Ayew, who only a few weeks ago I picked out as an underrated star in the Premier League, and you and Hugh Woozencroft laughed at me. So I'm pleased to see that you acknowledging his status as the Ghanaian David Beckham. Now, there's one part of this game that we're not yet talked about, and that's Inaki Williams. And do we think this is the best accidental dummy of the tournament, maybe of the World Cup ever? Because surely you'd be claiming it, right? You're thinking the guy's at the back post, the ball's coming across. Oh, no, I've left it, mate. I mean, this is another thing that I love about these games, the slight element of hilarity. We had it with Aboubakar's chip. This added to the sense, you know, fantastic, thrilling finish with that third goal. But there was a moment of comedy in there, in that your star striker completely fluffs his chance.
And he'll get an assist for it too, because he nicked him. That's what the commentator said at the time. It's like, did it touch him? Yes, that's an assist. I mean, that's kind of makes a fool of that statistic. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't think he'll care in the slightest.
Very true, very true. Now, of these four teams, obviously certain teams in more dire straits than others, but Alison, we've already talked about Serbia and your confidence of going into their final game. Ghana, 3 points going into their final game now when they play Uruguay. We'll talk about their game against Portugal shortly. Who do you guys feel of these teams that we're talking about in terms of the best games of the tournament so far? Which of them do you think has got the best chance of progressing? Greg, I'll start with you.
I mean, they're really, really hard to call. There's no doubt about it. Ghana, you'd have to say Ghana are playing better and look a bit more kind of dangerous, really, than Uruguay, although Uruguay will come on to speak about did kind of, again, when they were behind and had to do something to try and get back in the game or win the game, they did show that they have players, attacking players that they can get on the pitch and look a bit more dangerous. It's just, we're now in, you know, last chance saloon, so both of them are going to have to go at it. I would probably just edge for Ghana, because you have to say as well, the barrage that they withstood for good swathe of the second half against South Korea was pretty impressive as well. It's not just about, they didn't really carve out that many clear chances. They put lots of balls in the boxes, but they were always repelled. So I think Ghana looked quite strong, and Uruguay look a little bit jaded. And then Serbia and Switzerland is like another one's really hard to call. Really, really hard to call. I do think Serbia have possibly got a sting in the tail.
Alison, Robertson's done his classic fence sitting. Come on, help him out with some definitive predictions, will you?
I think Ghana have shown the most character. I mean, they were very, very unlucky not to get a draw with Portugal. Looked dangerous in that game. They clearly do a lot of work tactically. So I think they will go into their final game really well prepared. But I agree. I think Ghana are the stronger chance there. And I'm just not prepared to give up on Serbia, partly because they're just more fun than Switzerland, aren't they? I mean, the Swiss are really quite, I mean, they're admirable, but their approach is quite prim and conservative. So I'd rather Serbia went through.
Now, if Ghana are going to go through, they must face Uruguay in the final group game, which is sure to be a fiery clash. And obviously, there'll be revenge on the mind of the Ghanaians after that 2010 match in which Luis Suarez famously handled the ball on the line to deny them a goal, which then Asamoah Gyan then missed from the penalty spot. Uruguay losing last night to Portugal. Gregor, were we a bit disappointed? You touched on it there in terms of their tactics. They were talking about it on the commentary as well in terms of the slightly kind of restrained tactics that Uruguay showed until they went behind. Then they put some more exciting players on. I thought Palestri looked pretty bright, despite never having played for Manchester United and them spending £40 million on him or whatever it was. I thought he looked bright when he came on. But were you disappointed in them being so restrained to start with?
You can understand that this is their kind of DNA. We're talking about teams' identities, and that is very much Uruguay's identity. They are resolute and snarling. And I always thought they were going to be pretty hard to break down. And I think it proved to be true. I don't think Portugal really carved through them. It was a, as I'm sure we'll come to, that one ball into the box that they kind of, they lost concentration from, and basically, and I'm not sure whether Ronaldo can claim it or not, but I would say not.
Yeah, absolutely not. Let's just clear this up right now, right? Alison, surely you're in agreement as well. No chance that's his goal, right?
Well, but then, gentlemen, why would you say that it was? Are we accusing him of lying?
He's an egomaniac, Alison. That's why. Come on. There's absolutely no way that's his goal.
If the gentleman says it touched his head, then it touched his head.
Let's get the penalty out of the way too, then.
Yeah, let's get the penalty out of the way. Gregor, I mean, penalty?
Good God, no.
You must have been despairing as a former defender at that.
It's a shambles, yeah. And I've seen kind of people sharing things on social media saying that there's basically a law that says this very fact, that if it's a trailing arm, and it's like, then it's, this shouldn't be given. And you could even see the referee walking onto the pitch and sort of humming in hand to himself for ages. Like,
I couldn't work out whether he was
put his whistle to his
speaking,
mouth, took it back.
Yeah. Was he trying to remember the rules? Was he trying to remember the rules when he can? Now, hang on, if he falls over and his hand is there, now I'm supposed to, oh, sod it, I'm going to give it anyway, it doesn't matter.
That was a joke. But, you know, getting back to Uruguay, I thought Bentancur, and probably along with Bernardo Silva, were the two best players on the pitch. Bentancur is outstanding. He can do everything. He played so deep. He plays so deep for them, and kind of, but can still spark attacks and drive forward with the ball. He obviously did once in the first half and nearly scored. Probably should have. Valverde's got his full of drive too, but around them, no, there was very little. Nunes kind of huffed and puffed, and as you say, when Palestri came on, when Maxi Gomez came on, he had a good chance. Something happened at least. You know, they showed a bit more energy and life, but I'm not sure it's going to be enough for them.
But they don't, would you agree? I mean, I think their three at the back worked for a large chunk of the game. They looked quite comfortable. It wasn't a car crash performance,
no,
this.
No.
I think defensively they were okay. I agree with you about Bentancur. I think he looked like he's got a different personality with his nation as opposed to his club.
Yeah, you're going to be very excited as a Tottenham fan, aren't you, watching that, thinking, God, this guy's going to be great when we sign him in January.
But he did. There's a deference to him when he plays for Spurs. I don't know if that's the influence of his manager, whether he feels contained, but he certainly was given the permission to express himself in this game, and he did. And
he takes responsibility.
Yes, exactly.
Again, it's just players having to do that, and when they're under pressure, when they need to do it. And he's certainly someone who did it from the start, actually, and he was good in the first game too. I think he's been outstanding. But as I say, around them, you're looking at some fading lights like Cavani, Suarez when he came on, a solid, resolute team, but very little, you know, creatively. So they're going to have to change their whole mindset going into this last game.
Yeah, there seems to be some sort of like compulsion to play one of Suarez or Cavani, as though, you know, it's illegal not to. Whereas, in fact, this is the problem for young managers, maybe, that they just feel, these guys are gods. I can't drop all of them all, you know, at the same time. I've got to somehow fit them into a system. But you never, I mean, there's a part of me that kept thinking there'll be a moment of magic from one of them.
But there's also very little difference in what we've just been saying about Portugal. They didn't show a great deal of ambition. There was a lot of times, there was one time in the first half when Mendes, the left back, was bursting forward and no one even like attempted to try and get in the box to like, for a cross. It was just, he just kind of had to come back, and it was a good position. They just don't commit people forward, and maybe it is something to do with how kind of isolated Ronaldo seems. And yes, he got in there for an important moment, but it just feels like there's a lot of conservatism there too.
Ah, but okay, what do we think? Because a lot of the build-up to the tournament wasn't about the tournament, it was about Cristiano Ronaldo and Manchester United. And having seen two matches now, I wonder, do we feel that he's a hindrance or a help to his national team. I think he's a help. I think he still bothers opposition goalkeepers, opposition defenders. I think he has an arrogance that a lot of people on the world stage struggle with. And you could argue it doesn't matter whether he touched the ball or not. He was still there making it a difficult choice for the keeper. So that sheer personality he has, I think, and I have no evidence that he doesn't help the team, you know, G them up and make them feel like they're better than they might otherwise feel. I have a slight problem with clinging to the past for Uruguay, but I don't with Portugal. I think there's a validity to playing Ronaldo.
I absolutely agree, but I would also add that there's an argument that he could be both a hindrance and a help in various aspects of his play. And ultimately, when Portugal don't have the ball or when in quick transitions, he's not really effective. But if you put a ball in the box, there's no one's going to jump higher.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of those two factors for me. When you think about some of the things you said, Gregor, about some of those players in terms of committing bodies forward, some of those players, Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes, João Cancelo, they want to be playing intricate, quick passes, often in the turnovers. Ronaldo doesn't want that. Ronaldo wants the ball out wide and the ball into the box. So you've got two different styles of play essentially blended together. And the demeanours of some of those players almost look like, you know, it's that, like that moment when dad's still on the night out and he's not gone home yet. And you're like, oh, for God's sake, come on, we can't really be ourselves and have fun, you know, because the old bloke's still here wanting us to ping balls into the box for him. I agree, Alison, that that can still be effective, but it does. And I think it still holds them back. Now, in terms of Portugal going forward, 6 points, we're being quite critical, analytical, perhaps. Do you see them as being potential winners of the tournament, potential semi-finalists, either of you?
Not quite. Although Pepe, was that Pepe only? Was Pepe only playing because they knew there would be very old people in the opposition? It's like, it's even it up.
I think Danilo broke a rib or something, actually, which he didn't really know about until he got a scan. So he was kind of another warrior they have. They have that kind of that grittiness as well. But the fact is, if you look at the teams that have won major competitions, you even look at the way France played when they won it, they weren't great to watch. And they were solid defensively, had a good foundation, and they had someone who could produce moments. And, you know, we could say that about France again this year, which is why I still think they're going to be right up there. But Portugal could be that team too. They have the talent. So I wouldn't write them off.
Yep. Solid to beat. 6 points from two games. Top of the group. That leads us very neatly onto that famously boring World Cup team, Brazil. Following up that opening 2-0 win with a 1-0 win against Switzerland, I must say I was watching this after the first two games of excitement, thinking, here we go, here's another 0-0, until Casemiro's strike, which for me, for all the excitement in a very boring game when I know commentators want to latch on to something that they've seen, took a massive deflection off Akanji, which definitely caused Jan Sommer to get absolutely nowhere near it. I only have two questions on Brazil. Did they miss Neymar or did they look better without him? Alison Rudd.
I always think a team looks better without Neymar. I was at the game in Russia where he did his 300 rolls and I just thought, I don't like you. I think he's a flat track bully. I don't think he shines in the big games very often. I don't like players that have that sort of aura of being bigger than the rest of a very good team. Why would you say that? You could pick out a highlights reel and I bet you 85% of it would be against markedly weak opposition. And I think it gave Vinicius Junior a chance to shine more. I just felt there was a bit more space for him. I mean, even if it was just in terms of attitude in your head as opposed to on the field. So yeah, I wouldn't think they're weaker for the lack of him, no.
I think they did, but not like terribly so. They did because Brazil are at their very best when they're playing really quickly and there's movement and sharp play kind of between the lines, like we saw for the goal. You're right, there was a deflection, but that I look at that as well and think, I'm not really sure what Switzerland could have done about that. Akanji was confronting Brazil's holding midfielder, who'd made a run into the box. And after a lovely little flick by Rodrigo, Vinicius Jr. coming inside. I don't know, he was a bit unfortunate, but there wasn't much they could do, and that was just one piece. There was a few instances in the game where they played like that really quickly. First touch, little flicks around the box. or Vinicius Junior kind of bursting down the line and playing across. That one when he played the outside of his right foot was sublime. I just think that Neymar probably is better than anyone else they have at that occupying that space between the lines. So I think they could do with him being back for the round of 16. Absolutely.
And then, so you say round of 16, looking ahead to the knockouts, as we asked with Portugal, 6 points. Do you think they've got potential to go further than Portugal? Do you see better prospects for Brazil, Gregor?
Yes. At the moment, I would say Brazil, France, they're the two. They're the two for me. I think that they've got star quality. France have one player in particular who could win them the competition. Neymar is not that player for Brazil, but they have enough players that are kind of like Vinicius Junior. His pace is extraordinary. If Richarlison really wants to turn up and, you know, please you, Tom, he might do it. And they've got so many players off the bench too, so much attacking quality that I think they're the two teams to beat.
Alison, agree with that?
They're definitely the two grown-up teams of the tournament so far, you know, who haven't significantly wobbled, look reasonably efficient. I mean, the commentators keep saying things like, it's not like watching Brazil, but at times it is. At times it is, and they do produce moments. Now, of course, it's nothing like being back in the 70s or whatever, but they probably have, I don't know, they have slightly more swagger than France. Probably they do. But if it came down to a final between the pair of them, then I would make France like favourites.
Yep, that's right. Brazil showing why they are one of the favourites for the tournament, and Portugal looking pretty difficult to beat too. Now, up next, we'll be looking ahead to the big one, England v Wales.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, given that the three of us analysed England and Wales games on Friday night, and we'll be back on the Game podcast tomorrow to review the action, we thought, and as well, let's be honest, Gregor Robertson, our poor Scottish friend, is sick to death of us analysing England over and over again. We thought we'd give you a break, Gregor. And so we thought we'd give someone else a go. Earlier, I spoke to two of the biggest fans of both teams out in Qatar, Jack, who has been following England, and George, who is a Wales fan. This is what they had to say. Now, I'd like to start by getting an assessment from both of you on how your teams have performed so far, because it's been a little bit up and down. You both had kind of what were seen as good starts, I would say, in differing ways, and then slightly being brought back down to earth. Now, I'd say that assessment applies a little bit more to Wales. So, George, I'm going to start with you. How have you found it as a fan watching your team? And could I have a rating out of 10?
Yeah, well, grueling was definitely the answer for the Iran game. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the toughest experiences as a Wales fan I've probably ever had, to be honest, watching a game. We've played four halves of football and I think we've shown what we can do in one of them, which probably isn't good enough. I mean, there's a general sense from most of the Wales fans out here that we are just happy to be here. It's been great being at a World Cup and being on the world stage. But frankly, some of the performances haven't been good enough, especially not against Iran. I mean, it was so hot there. I was sort of at the front of the stand in the red wall in the heat. And I think that possibly has been one, not that I'm making excuses for our team, but one factor that's been slightly overlooked was just how hot it was. But I think everyone came out that game thinking we just didn't show what we can do. We played so much better with this team. The USA game definitely had some positives, especially in the second half, bringing on Kiefer Moore, changed how we played. I think the only problem there is that some people have said this, when you start Kiefer Moore, you then can't bring on Kiefer Moore. And you know, we started him against Iran. He's excellent against tired defences, but Gareth Bale didn't really have the legs to run off him in the way that maybe Dan James does sometimes. Not that I wouldn't play Gareth Bale. So it's hard to give a rating because, as I say, I'm really, really pleased we're here, and we're all so behind this Wales team, and they've done so many great things in the last few years. But based purely on the performances of this tournament, I'd probably go a 4, a 5 if I'm generous. I mean, it hasn't really been good enough.
A generous 5 and one good half of football out of 4. That is pretty tough going for Wales fans. But I've got to say, I'd probably agree with you, George. Now, Jack, how about you? How have you assessed England's performances so far? You've been at both the games, the highs of the Iran win and then the lows of the drab draw with USA. What do you reckon?
I really enjoyed the first game. Obviously, the Iran win, it was brilliant. 6 goals, you don't see that very often in a World Cup game. And I was lucky enough to be there to see it, albeit Iran didn't put up much of a fight. The USA draw was dull, as all 0-0 draws really are. But I feel like a lot of overreaction has been happening back home with England fans and even here. I just think as a nation, we are very, very negative when it comes to football. We're used to disappointment. But, you know, looking at our past two tournaments, a semi-final and a final, people like to jump on the bandwagon of a 0-0 draw, a dull performance, we're not good enough. You know, play like that against France or Brazil and we'll get battered. You know, we've seen teams in the past, Germany in 2014, they drew with Ghana. They scraped past a much weaker US team. And they went on to win the tournament. Spain in 2010 lost their first game to Switzerland, arguably the greatest national side ever. And I'm not saying we're going to go in and win it very fast.
Go on, Jack. Go on, you can do it.
But, you know, it's one of those things. I think tournament football, when have you ever seen when was the last time you saw a team come out of a group in a World Cup with 9 points? It needs to be taken into account. You know, Gareth on the night probably thought, you know, we're not playing well. Let's take a point, regroup, go again against Wales on Tuesday. Whatever you want to say about Gareth Southgate as a manager and tactically and whatnot, he's got us in 2 tournaments, major tournaments, a final and a semi-final. We're getting there. We have a great young squad. So I'm still optimistic of what's to come. Obviously, there are teams out there like Brazil, France, Spain, even, who are playing brilliant football. But it's knockout football. It's a World Cup. You never know what's going to happen. So, yeah, I think we're still in it with a chance. And obviously, hoping we go out and smash Wales on Tuesday.
The fighting talk's begun. So I assume that's 10 out of 10 then, Jack, if you're asked for a rating.
I wouldn't say 10 out of 10, obviously. Like that US game wasn't great. I'm just trying to put it into perspective. I'd give us 6-7 out of 10.
6-7, that's fair. On the idea of 6-7 out of 10 then, I presume that like a lot of fans, you might be making changes for this final game if you were given the chance to play Gareth Southgate's role. Would you be making changes to that England starting lineup?
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing said about that US game was the in-game management and the substitutions made. I didn't agree with, like a lot of people, I assume. Definitely 2 changes I would make are Mason Mount and Raheem Sterling. I just think they were pretty ineffective. And judging on their club form as well over this season, I just don't think they should be in that team. You could say the same for people like Harry Maguire, but he has been performing the past 2 games. So the changes I'd go with, I'd bring Foden in for Mount. I think it was criminal to leave him on the bench for 90 minutes when we were looking for a goal. And I'd bring either Grealish or Rashford in on the left for Sterling. But other than that, you know, I wouldn't really change it too much. I still have faith in that team and the squad.
George, you've heard those changes suggested from Jack there. Does that worry you? And if so, how would you change it for Wales going into this must-win game?
Well, I mean, it sort of feels like from a Welsh fan perspective, looking at that England team, you know, when I was watching the England-Iran game earlier in the tournament, just watching it in a cafe here and watching some of the players that can come off the bench, the strength of depth in that England team is unbelievable. So even a slightly changed England team, and as you say, you know, like someone like Foden coming in, it sort of doesn't make a huge amount of difference to how we view it, because we know these are players, are massive, massive sort of quality players that can make a difference. And certainly if they, you know, if they were Welsh, we'd love to have them starting for our team. I think in terms of what we might do, I mean, we've got one enforced change, which should be that Danny Ward will start after Wayne Hennessy's red card. That might slightly change how we play. I mean, Hennessy's probably a better shot stopper, kind of old school goalkeeper, if you like. Danny Ward, my fear with him is that he does have a bit of a mistake in him. He made one terrible mistake in qualifying against Czech Republic, but he is pretty good with his feet, which might help us play out from the back a little bit. I thought we were quite poor at doing that against Iran. Otherwise, I wouldn't be inclined to change too much, which might be surprising given how poor we were against Iran. The one change I would certainly want Rob Page to make, and I think he will make, is start Joe Allen if he's fit. That's a huge question mark. Allen hasn't played for months coming into the tournament. Looked really quite rusty against Iran when he came on. But a few more days of training in his legs, I'd hopefully hope he's fit. And I'd probably bring him in for Harry Wilson. You know, there's been calls on, I heard you guys on the game the other day sort of discussing potentially Bale and or Ramsey dropping out. And yep. I've heard Wales fans out here say the same thing. Personally, I don't think that will happen. I wouldn't want it to happen. I think if Page does that, he potentially opens himself up to a lot of criticism if we lose, and especially if we were to lose badly. I also think, you spend these few days saying to Bale and Ramsey, this probably is going to be your last ever shot at a World Cup game, really. If you're not going to get up for it in a World Cup must-win game against England and give 110%, then when are you? Yeah. You know, play them, get in their heads, have a big talk with them. They were poor against Iran. Ramsey's been our poorest player at the tournament, I think, but they are still game changers. And they're not that old. You know, people are talking about they're past it. Aaron Ramsey is still in his early 30s. He's by no means, you know, he has fitness issues, but I'd play them. I'd bring Joe Allen in, and I think I'd keep it pretty much the same otherwise.
I love it, guys. Such faith. Jack, you've got faith in Gareth Southgate, and Georgia, you've got faith in the old guard of the Welsh team. I love it. Absolutely love it. Loyal to the very end. Now, I wanted to talk to both of you about your experiences as fans in Qatar. Obviously been a huge talking point going into the tournament and whilst we've been watching the games. A tournament like no other, a lot of people have called it. I myself have been to a World Cup as a fan. I went to South Africa in 2010. I'm fascinated to know what your experiences have been like, be it from whether you've been able to find any booze, which you'll know has been a big subject for fans going out there, what the atmospheres have been like, what it's been like to mingle with other fans, you know, who you were there with. Are you there in big groups with supporters? You know, paint us a picture of what it's been like. George, I'm going to start with you.
It's been absolutely fascinating, and I've really enjoyed my time here. I'm cards on the table, I've come out here from quite a privileged position as a, you know, a straight white male, and that sort of perhaps politically works in kind of my favour. But I'm going to speak from my own perspective, and it's been a really enjoyable tournament. I've never been to this part of the world anyway, and first few days were quite a culture shock. I mean, it's very, very different to the Western world here, but yeah. It being in one city has been great. I think my sort of concern before coming was that maybe the kind of infrastructure of a city this size couldn't cope with the influx of fans, and that's arguably been the best thing about the tournament. Travel here is great. It's really cheap to get around. The city is very, very easy to navigate, and there's just, it feels like you're in the middle of a festival of football. There are you look one way and there's, you know, 100 Brazil fans playing drums, and then you see, you know, a bunch of Mexicans with sombreros on having a great time. Regards to the booze, it's harder to get than in the UK, but it's not that hard to get. It's expensive. I mean, that I'd say nothing else is particularly expensive. Transport's unbelievably cheap. Food's generally quite reasonable. Alcohol, it's really not hard to find. It is more just a question of how much you're willing to spend a night, to be honest. But the benefit
of that is, how much are you willing to spend, George? Come on, you're going to have to fess up now.
Well, I suppose I'll put it this way, is that the benefit is that I've been here for about 8 days and I've not had one hangover since I've been here. So that explains it. But it's generally looking £13-14 a pint. Oof. In most of the bars. Yeah, it is steep, but it's there. The football's on everywhere. Yeah, it's a really different place for me to have come to, and it's not an experience I'll forget anytime soon.
Jack, would you agree with that assessment? How have you found it? Are you there with a group of pals? Are you there with supporters, friends, family? Who are you there with?
I'm here with parents. My parents live here. So I've been lucky enough to, I'm going to be here for the whole tournament. And yeah, I agree with everything George said. It's been fantastic. Like, I know the place already. I know what the culture's like. I didn't have that many reservations about, you know, this tournament being a bad one or whatever, because I knew, I know what this place is like. And I think it's really blown out of proportion in terms of all the political agendas that have been going on and everything that's being said back in the UK. I think there comes a time where you just need to, you know, the World Cup's here. We need to just get on with it. And we need to just try and make the most of, you know, the biggest sporting event in the world. But yeah, when George was saying about the, you know, everything being in the same city, I found it fantastic. Like, I was in Moscow in 2018 for the semi-final. And that was brilliant. But like, there's nothing like this. Like, you can get to one ground from the other on a match day in within an hour. Like, we're going to two quarterfinals in the same day, one at 6 and one at 10. And the infrastructure and the, you know, for travel and everything makes it possible. Like, the metro's free to use, air conditioned. It makes the tube look in London look awful. So yeah, it's been fantastic. Alcohol, yeah, it's not cheap, but for a strict Muslim country, it hasn't been that hard to find. All the fan zones, fan parks, you know, that it's not just the official FIFA ones. There are places everywhere that you can get your hands on alcohol, and I've been a few times. George is saying he hasn't had a hangover yet. I unfortunately have. the morning after the US game was a bit rough, but yeah, it's been amazing, and I've really enjoyed it, and obviously I'm going to enjoy the rest of it.
Great. Now, this has been a very civilized fan head-to-head, I've got to say, you know, and I know we're the Times, so we can be all polite about it, but I'm going to end with a prediction, which maybe is a chance for you to rile each other up. And now, Jack, you were talking earlier about knockout games and quarterfinals. So I'm assuming that you're seeing this final match against Wales as a procession. Give me a prediction.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching Wales and I've enjoyed it. Let's just say that. I think they've been dragged through everything by Gareth Bale the past few years. And now that he's finally getting on and he can't do it anymore, they have nowhere to turn. So I think that it will be comfortable for England. I'm going to go 4-1.
4-1. George, just when you thought you could be best pals and meet up for a beer, Jack's punched holes right in that future friendship. Chance for you to respond with a final prediction for us.
Yeah, I'll be keeping an eye out for Jack outside the ground beforehand. I think speaking to other Wales fans out here, I think quite a lot of us are expecting now to go home on Wednesday. We realise getting through is going to be very hard. I don't think many of us expect to beat England. I don't know that many of us expect us to draw. We'd love to. I just want us to see us leave everything on the pitch. If that means we lose by a couple of goals, that is fine. I just would like to go home off the back of that game and say, yeah, every player out there gave it their all. If you want my honest opinion, I probably see the score being not that far off what Jack said.
I don't want your honest opinion, George. I want your deluded, right, patriotic opinion. Come on.
We're gonna win 4-0. USA are going to win. And we're going to run through to the round of 16 and all the way on to the final. Come on, Cymru.
Wonderful. There we go. So, chaps, thank you very much for joining the Game Podcast, and I wish you both a wonderful rest of the tournament. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
So there we go. Thanks to Jack and George, who gave us their insights earlier in this.
Is Jack your kind of co-chairman of the Gareth Southgate Appreciation Society, or what?
No, I don't want any accusations of any kind of plants or anything like that. I had never met Jack before he appeared on the show. He just happened to be a very intelligent man who happened to be firmly planted in the Team Gareth camp. Now, I wonder whether the Team Gareth camp will have more work to do tomorrow. We're hearing reports tonight that Gareth Southgate might be on the verge of going back to a back five. Kyle Walker looking like he might be in the team. Jordan Henderson back into midfield just to shore it up, you know. Gareth must have been worried after watching that fantastic Wales performance against Iran. Now, we heard predictions there from both the guys. Jack being pretty confident, he went for a 4-1 win. And George giving two different predictions, of course. He went for a 4-1 England win as well. But then when I challenged him to be a bit more patriotic, he said that Wales would triumph. Alison, what do you think will happen?
Yeah, probably be 0-0, won't it?
Oh, here we go. Here we go. She's used up all her excitement on Serbia and Cameroon and Ghana and South Korea. 0-0, if you say so. Gregor, come on, you must be expecting a few goals, surely.
Yeah, I feel like it could be. I think it's going to be tight. you know, there's something very different about games between nations from the British Isles.
So 0-0, that's what you're saying.
No, I think like 2-1 to England.
2-1 to England. I've got to say, I think I agree with you. I think my only predictions are that I think Wales will score, I think England will win, and I think that this time tomorrow we'll all be slagging off Gareth Southgate, apart from me and Jack, of course. Legendary Jack, good lad. So thanks to him and to George and to Gregor and to Alison. And thank you all for listening to the Game World Cup podcast. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about, I'm sure, a triumphant England victory over Wales and their clean progression through to the knockouts. Thanks for listening.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.